It's lovely to be back. We had a nice time with family and friends over Christmas and the New Year, but it's good to be back here as well. Did anyone eat too much over the holidays? Did anyone not eat too much over the holidays? Well done, Paul. Very good. Well done. Okay, well, respect. Yes, I have quite a lot of seasonal variation in my weight, I've realised, and I don't know if it's any correlation to how much I eat, so I'm not sure, I'm still exploring that, but I think I've told you before, I've got those little tags on my coat hangers. Have I told you this? Because my seasonal variation is so much that in the winter, a whole different set of clothes fit me compared to the summer, and it's very confusing, and it can waste a lot of time in the morning working out, so I bought a big box of these tags that you put on. Medium, large, extra large, and I've moved from the reds to the yellows. Too much turkey, too many mince pies. Managed to stay away from the stollen somehow, but I ate too much. So anyway, the national diet has begun, yeah? Feasting's okay as long as it's followed by fasting. So we're in a fasting period. I just want to say a bit about this time tomorrow. Why are we doing this? Well, here's a picture of 100 dots, okay? And some of you will already recognize these dots, because if you're familiar with the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity's resources, you'll know where I'm going with this. Here's 100 dots representing 100% of the population of the UK, okay? And here we have seven red dots, and these seven red dots represent the between 6 and 7% of the UK population that attend church at least once a month, okay? Not like the old days, but anyway, at least once a month. So there they are. And as you can see, that's a Sunday morning because the dots are all congregated together. And that's good. That feels very encouraging. We're very encouraged. As you can see, we are in the minority in this country in terms of our faith. And so it's lovely when we come together and encourage one another. But this is what Monday morning might look like. As you can see, now we are scattered all over the place, in different places of work, different activities and pursuits that we're involved in. And that's a good thing, because Jesus said, be salt and light. Sunday mornings are lovely, but we can't really be salt and light in our community if we stay like that. So this is a very positive thing. Now, I'm coming at this in another way. There are 168 hours in a week, okay? Now, let's say you spend 2 hours of that coming to church on a Sunday morning. Yeah, about 2 hours, is it? 10:35 to 12:35, something like that. And let's say 10:29 this morning, Dave. Very impressive. We should do that more often. And let's say you also spend another 2 hours in the week specifically getting Christian fellowship, maybe in a home discipleship group, or you've got people you pray with or whatever. Okay, so let's say you spend 4 hours of your week like that, but that leaves 164 where you're like that. Now, I haven't included sleep, so don't take this too seriously, but this tells me two things. First of all, the box on the left tells me how important Christian fellowship is. Because actually, we, as a proportion of our week, we may spend 2.5% of our week, of our hours available, having active Christian fellowship where we are specifically here to encourage our faith. 2.5% of our week, 4 hours. So our fellowship is important. And that's why this term, we are going to be looking at the quality of our fellowship as Christians together. I'll say more about that in a moment, obviously. But the other 164 hours tells us how vital it is that we work out our faith in the context in which we find ourselves. In our workplace, doing acts of service, in our home lives. It's vital that our faith is worked through in those areas, because guess what? 164 hours of our week are spent there. So in a way, Sundays and midweeks are a bit like that. Wayne's not here, is he, Wayne Thomas, this morning? But that's a Welsh rugby team, I think. Our Sundays are a bit like the team huddle, aren't they? It's like It's half time, we get together, see how things are going. But the team huddle's not the main event. So I hope that we can, by thinking about what we're going to be doing this time tomorrow, I hope it can remind us that we are Christians in our places of work or where we spend our time. It is about witness for Christ. It's not just about that, it's also about how our faith informs the way we go about our work. So, in terms of Sunday mornings this term, we have a lot coming up. In a week or two, we have an initial visit from a prospective minister. Okay, so it's just the initial visit. It's not preach with a view. So if you see a new face up here, then you'll know what that's about. And it's not James, okay, because he's next week. We're going to have a Sunday where we're going to focus on Barton and Northway. I'll tell you about that soon, Pete and Lynette. And hopefully Wheatley Community Church, because many of our people went to Wheatley and they've now got a minister, which is very exciting, Al Nichol, or McNichol. Anyway, we have our weekend away coming up this month, at the end of the month, and that's thrilling. And if you haven't booked your place, please let us know as soon as possible, because space is very limited. We have a baptismal service, and some of our young people are going to be baptized at that. So be praying for them and for others who might join them. And we are going to have a youth service where we are going to get our youth involved in shaping a service and sharing significantly at that service. And that will be very exciting. That's in March. So there's lots of good things coming up. But in between all that, we're going to have this sermon series, which is looking at how we relate to one another, the quality of our fellowship. And in a way, there's, I hope, a pattern to the whole year. Because last term, if you remember, we looked at that theme of meeting Jesus. And I hope next term we'll be looking at how we reach out to others. And this term we're looking at how we relate to ourselves. So we're looking at those different, the vertical relationship, the inward relationship in fellowship, and the outward in outreach. Okay, so that's the sort of thrust of the year. So, our series this term, peppered between all the different events, is the one another's of the New Testament. And next week, a display will appear here with the one another's, or some of them. When is the Christmas tree supposed to come down? Is it tomorrow? Yeah, 12th night. Okay, so that will be gone. So we'll have a display about this, but the one another's. And now the phrase one another, in English it's two words, isn't it? And we had long debates about whether that was hyphenated or not. I don't believe it is, but it's one word. But in Greek it's a single word, and there it is. Sorry, those are Greek letters, but what they spell there is allelon. Allelon, which means one another. And so you can see there's a few examples there. Admonish one another. Sing to one another. Be kind to one another, greet one another, and so on. Be patient with one another. There are lots of different one another's. And you can sort of try to categorize them, because this word allelon, it's actually in the New Testament 100 times, exactly 100 times, okay? So people have tried to group them into nice, neat little parcels. So some say, well, you can group a load of them under love, and others under unity, and others under humility. But what we're going to do is we're going to look at these five, okay? So, honour one another. Let me get them in the right order here. Honour one another, encourage, love, forgive one another, and care for one another. And I'm sure a couple of the others will get drawn into those five. So today we're going to begin with honour one another. Need to correct the spelling there, sorry. There we are. Honour one another. What does it mean to honour one another? Well, the dictionary describes the verb to honour as regarding someone with great respect or esteeming them highly. Okay, this is slightly dangerous, but I want you to look around at the people around you and say, and ask yourself, am I regarding the people here with honour? And no one's doing it, by the way, at all, but anyway, maybe that's good. Are we honoring one another? Are we esteeming one another? Are we valuing each other highly? Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that out in the world, honor has to be earned. Yeah? I will honor you if you're worthy of honor. And if you're not, I won't. We have the honor system here in the UK, where if you're really good, you get to visit the Queen and you might receive a CB or an OBE or a knighthood. I don't think anyone in this fellowship has received these. If you have, you've been very quiet and humble about it. Of course, as a nation, we're not always good at giving honour, even when we should. So in 2008, UEFA launched their respect campaign to try to get people to show respect to others regardless of their gender or their ethnicity or even their ability, which is quite a statement for football, respect. So we live in a culture, I think, where honour has to be earned, but even when honour is due, we don't necessarily give it. But God has something far better for us, for his people of the church. So we're going to have a look at Philippians 2, verses 1 to 4. Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, rather in humility value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. So, these are words spoken to the church at Philippi. Church at Philippi was the very first church that Paul founded in Europe. When Paul wrote the letter, he was in prison. Philippi was a good church, but it wasn't perfect. And we know from chapter 4 that at least two of the people there weren't getting on. Euodia and Syntyche, who Paul pleaded with them to agree together in the Lord. And we see also through Philippians that time and again, Paul sees that spiritual growth, true spiritual growth, will result in changed relationships amongst ourselves. So it's a bit of a tricky few sentences. I've restructured that. I hope you can still see that. But as I go through it, hopefully that will help to see the flow of what Paul is saying. So Paul begins with these four rather staccato phrases. What Paul is saying right at the top there, basically, is if this is what you believe, then this is how you should behave, okay? Or, to put it perhaps more profoundly, if this is your experience of the blessing of your relationship with God, then this is a blessing that should pour out as you relate to others, okay? So Paul asks them these four questions, and of course he expects the answer to be yes. Of course, they have been encouraged from being united with Christ. Of course, they have received some comfort from his love. Of course, they have this common sharing in the Spirit. Of course, they have experienced the tenderness and compassion of God. Of course they have. Then Paul's saying, if you've experienced any or all of these, then make my joy complete, he says. Speaking as the founder of the church, he had a keen burden for them. Make my joy complete by what? By being like-minded, so one in mind, by having the same love, so one in heart, and being one in spirit and purpose, so having the same purpose, okay? That's not a bad place to start. The start of a new decade, is it, for us? Being one in mind, heart, and purpose. That's a perfect 2020 vision, isn't it? I had to get that in there somewhere today. Get it out of the way. 2020 vision. We are a very diverse group of people in here. We're from different walks of life. There are different languages represented in this room. There are different ethnicities here. But we can be one in mind, heart, and purpose because we are drawn together by Christ. We're drawn by him, and he has made his will very clear that his desire for us, as he prayed in John 17, is that we be one, that we live in unity with each other. But there are some obstacles to this oneness, and three, actually, which you pick out in red there. Selfish ambition, vain conceit, and then at the bottom, self-centeredness, I guess. So, selfish ambition. Don't know if this, if you're ever tempted to act like this. You want to get to the top, and quite frankly, you're prepared to walk over a few other people to get there. You want to be seen to be better than others, to be somehow better equipped, better able, better, more intelligent than others, whatever it might be. But we can be guilty of selfish ambition. In fact, selfish ambition is so popular in our culture that the BBC have made a program out of it, haven't they? Called The... Thank you. The Apprentice. Nothing wrong with ambition. Ambition is a good thing if it's directed healthily and appropriately, but selfish ambition is self-serving, it's obviously selfish, and it's sinful. Okay. And then we have the second one there, vain conceit. Vain conceit. Vanity, I had to check the dictionary for these just to get the definitions right. Vanity is having or showing an excessively high opinion of one's appearance, abilities, or worth. Okay? And conceit is being excessively proud of yourself. Actually, basically, the words mean the same thing. But Paul has put them together to doubly emphasize his point that one of the obstacles to us truly honoring each other is not just having a low opinion of others, it's also, and of course it goes with that, having a very high opinion of ourselves. And I don't know if that rings true here. I think we're all capable of this at different days of the year. Some of us may suffer from a boasted sense of self-importance. There is a thing called narcissism, which is showing an excessive interest in yourself and admiring yourself. You know, and in some ways we see evidence of narcissism in our culture, the selfie generation, all that sort of thing. And God would say to us, I believe, avoid vain conceit. Don't be conceited. Don't think you're better than others. And then that third obstacle at the bottom there, which is just old-fashioned self-centeredness. Of course, we all do need to look after our own interests, but not to the exclusion of considering the interests and the needs of others. Okay, and then Paul gives us the antidote to these, doesn't he? He says that we should, in humility, value others above ourselves. I can't help thinking what therapists would make of this, you know. I don't think they'd recommend this. You know, just you going through life thinking everyone is better than yourself, they would say it's probably a recipe for disaster. But two things I want to say to that. First of all, let's remember who Paul is speaking to here. He is speaking to people who have a problem with selfish ambition and vain conceit. And they need to, it's a real corrective to them to actually remember or at least consider that others are better than themselves. But the other thing to say is that when we know Jesus, when we know him, when we understand the immense value that God has placed in us because we're made in his image, then we can afford to be generous in how we view others, can't we? We can waste so much energy trying to protect our self-worth. Yeah, we've all done it, surely. We can try to defend our sense of significance. And it comes out in all sorts of ways. It comes out in passive aggression. It comes out in aggression. It comes out in our words. Sometimes, perhaps worst of all, it comes out silently and invisibly in just our attitudes to others, that we've judged them even before they've opened their mouths. We've already decided who they are and what they're about. Or we just look at others and we say, well, you know, I respect these people, but these people not so much, because I have a value system and they don't cope very well on my value system, on my set of values. So I'm never going to tell them this, and I won't admit it in church, but actually I think some people are just a bit beneath. When we belong to God, God brings us into an amazing place of freedom. Because when we belong to God, we don't need to use our achievements as weapons to defend our value. I've done that. I've sometimes pursued goals in life, and I desperately wanted them. Everything in me has cried out to achieve this thing. Because I think, if I just get there, if I just do that, then somehow I'll have arrived. And of course, it never works, because if that's your mindset, there's always another summit that you're going to face that's coming up next, and next and next, and you will just be perennially unhappy in life if all you're doing is pursuing the next achievement, because it gives you something that you lack. And I remember once I was walking the dog. There was something I really wanted. I'll tell you what it is, but it's nothing major. Wasn't a job here. I was walking the dog, and I realized that this thing that I desperately wanted that was fueling, I thought would fuel my self-worth, I had to let go of it. And it really frustrated me when I realized that the only way I will have a sense of worth is if I take it from God. And that really bugged me, because I didn't want that. I wanted to do it myself. And I had to say, yeah, God, there is no substitute. Nothing will take that place. You know, so we don't, when we belong to God, we don't need to use our achievements as weapons to defend our value. We don't need to use our position in life, whatever that might be, to protect our status and our self-worth. Instead, we can live, to use a phrase that some of you have heard before, we can live an undefended life. An undefended life. We can do that because our security is in God. Our security is in who God says we are. We're in his image. Therefore, we have value. There's a sacredness to life because of that. We also have security in the value that God has evidently placed upon us by his self-giving at the cross. Such is the value God sees in us. Okay, so this is our security, these things. And because of that, we can genuinely live for others and we can genuinely honor others without thinking, oh, if I honor them, I might diminish myself. That will never happen to you if your security is in Christ. We can have that old acronym, JOY, J-O-Y, which is what? Jesus first. Thank you, Tricia. Jesus first, yourself last, and others in between. I don't know if I shared this story before. I might have done, but when I... Steve, sorry. I always bring up these pictures, don't I? I should bring the Taj Mahal next time, okay? But here's an Indian toilet, okay? And when I lived in India, when I taught at the college over there, we sometimes had problems with first-year students refusing to clean the toilets. And it's because they said, well, look, I'm Brahmin. I'm from the Brahmin caste. And, you know, Hindu understanding and Indian cultural tradition is that Brahmins do not clean toilets. That's right, isn't it? Yeah. So, first-year students, Brahmins. No, I'm not going to do it. So they go to the dean of students and they tell them. And he'd say, okay. But then what would happen is, when it would have been their turn on the rota, he would go and do their duty for them, unannounced, but other people would notice. They say, why is Virgis, sir, cleaning the toilets? The thing is, the dean of students was also a Brahmin. And without fail, all of those first-year Brahmin students would change their mindset because of the example of that dean of students. How could he do that, the dean? He could do it because his worth did not come from his caste. His worth didn't come from his class. His worth came from Christ. We are never going to honor people if our worth and our security is not centrally coming from Christ. We'll be too insecure, yeah? So get that right, and we can really be wonderful to one another. Now, the more astute amongst you will have noticed that although our title is Honor One Another, that phrase doesn't occur in Philippians 2 in the text, okay? I hope you'll agree with me, though, that the whole flow of Philippians 2 is to do with that. But just in case you're not fully satisfied, here is a verse that does have that expression. Romans 12, verse 10, be devoted to one another in love, honor one another above yourselves. Okay, very much in the spirit of what we've seen from Philippians. So God calls us to honor one another. That requires humility. Could you put your hands up if you're humble? Thank you. Got to be humble. 1 Peter 5, verse 5b. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another, because God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. In other words, God wants a quality of relationship amongst us that is fueled by the fruit of his spirit that is in us if we belong to Christ. There's fruit of love and gentleness and kindness and others, which actually enable us to be this way, to honor others. It's a gift of God. We need it. We can't work it up. It's something that comes from the Spirit. But all of this is not just for this. It's not just so that we have lovely Sunday morning services. Of course, that's great if we do, but it's not even so we have great midweek meetings or so that we just know we belong to a lovely family here. It's also for this, isn't it? Because we want to model the life of Christ and the fruit of the Spirit and the values of God's kingdom where we are for those other 164 hours. Just want to finish by reminding us of that story where Jesus washed the disciples' feet, John 13. And of course, that happened on the night in which he was betrayed. It happened the night before Jesus went to the cross. Jesus and the disciples, they'd gone to the upper room, and they, I'm sure, had dirty feet because the roads are dusty. And the cultural practice was that you would have your feet washed. It was an act of hospitality. In rich homes, that foot washing would be done by the servants. In poorer homes, it would be done by the husband or the wife. Who were the hosts in the upper room? There weren't any, because it was rented. It was a rented room. There was no host. So who should have done the foot washing, do you think? Well, culturally, it should have been the youngest of the disciples. The very last person that should have been doing it was Jesus, because he was their rabbi. And yet that's exactly what Jesus did. In fact, in the whole of Greco-Roman and Jewish literature, Jesus washing the disciples' feet is the only example we have of a superior, if I can use that phrase, washing the feet of an inferior. Okay? And Jesus took off his outer clothing, he wrapped a towel around him, which is how the servants dressed. So he looked visually like a servant, and he washed their feet. Why did he do it? He did it because even after this three-year time with Jesus, three-year theology courses, three-year in-house training time, they still hadn't got the point. And, on that night when Jesus was betrayed, they began discussing which of them was the greatest. And so Jesus washed their feet to show them how they should be thinking about each other. And I can't help wondering if somebody washed Jesus' feet. We're not told. Although we do know that a few days earlier, Mary had anointed his feet with that perfume and dried his feet with her hair. So that's something at least. But after washing their feet, Jesus said this. He said, "Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet." We have many different ways of showing honor in our culture, or our cultures, I should say. Foot washing may not be one of them, but the spirit, the heart of what Jesus is saying is as timely for us today as it was then. We need to honor one another. So it's hard to give an application to this, but let's just be aware as a fellowship, as we mingle, as we mix, let's esteem one another. Let's honor each other. Let's make sure our security is in Christ. And then we can be that community that Christ wants us to be. I'm going to sing a song before we take communion. They've told me what it is and I've promptly forgotten. Lord, I need you. That's it. Lord, I need you. Do you want us to stand there? Let's stand to sing.